Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, actress and producer Kate Cortelio talks about her bold new film, Ask for Jane, which chronicles the real-life Jane Collective, which offered underground abortion services in Chicago in the 1960s. You'll also hear from dancer and choreographer Yvonne Ng. That's all coming up on Endeavors. My first guest is an actress, activist, and producer who has appeared in TV shows such as Bull, Ollie and Molly Can't Get Arrested, A Lady's Guide to Making Conversation More Interesting, and The Nick. She is also a producer and a writer, and produced and came up with the idea for the bold new feature film, Ask for Jane. Ask for Jane is based on the Jane Collective, a group of determined Midwestern women who begin providing safe but illegal abortions in the 1960s. It was directed by Rachel Carey and co-stars Chloe Levine, Cody Horn, Sarah Steele, Ben Rappaport, Sophie Von Hasselberg, Sarah Ramos, Sarah Steele, and features a cameo appearance from one of the original members of the Jane Collective. The guest is Kate Cortelio, and I spoke with her last week. Here is our conversation.
Kate Cortelio, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you.
So you are the star, the producer of this new film, Ask for Jane. And I know that this film actually started with a story that you came up with. What made you want to tell the story of the Jane Collective?
I really wanted to tell this story because I feel like it's an important piece of women's history. I learned about it when I watched a documentary a couple years back, and it was just the whole history of feminism and women's liberation, and they mentioned the Jane Collective for 2 minutes in this doc, and I was floored and upset that I had never heard about it before. It's this incredible story about these women in Chicago in the late 1960s who formed an underground abortion referral service, and they ultimately learned how to do the procedure themselves and just cut doctors out of the equation almost entirely, and they ended up helping over 11,000 women before Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973. And I felt like this should be in history books. This should be taught in schools. How had I never heard of this? So I really wanted to make the movie just to tell the story, because I think if we don't learn from our mistakes, history becomes cyclical.
How did the process of writing the movie, how closely did you work with writer-director Rachel Carey to craft the narrative?
I would say a lot of it was her. I had the idea for the story, and I wrote out a treatment that night. And I'm not so much of a writer. I do it here and there, but I really felt like the story was so big and important that I wouldn't want to do it a disservice. I wanted someone who was really skilled, and I thought that person was Rachel. So I took it to her the next day, and I said, what do you think? Here's my idea. Would you maybe want to write the whole screenplay and be partners on this? And thank goodness she said yes. And she took my little treatment, and she made it into so much more than I ever imagined. I think she did such a beautiful job. I'm really proud of it.
There's yourself, there's Rachel, most of the lead cast is women. You've got Sarah Ramos, Sarah Steele, Julia Tellis. How important was that for a story like this to be told by women, and also given the cultural moment that we're in right now, how important was that?
It was very important. I mean, I think it's a story about women and for women and by women, but I actually want to expand that because I know that in the whole conversation around abortion and around reproductive rights right now and in the women's movement, a lot of trans folks are feeling left out, and I think that it should be expanded to include people with uteruses, anybody who is able to get pregnant. That's the story who it's for. And we were conscious of that behind the scenes too, with respect in front of and behind the camera. So it was a lot of women and a lot of diversity and inclusiveness behind the scenes as well.
And I know you also have a cameo appearance in this movie from Judith Arcana, who is one of the original members of the Jane Collective. How did you get her involved in this film?
It's funny because she actually found us early on. This was March of 2017 when we were pitching to investors and putting together the investor deck and everything. I was reaching out to all my different circles. I'm a volunteer with Planned Parenthood, and I work with the New York Women in Film and Television. And someone knew someone who knew Judith and passed her info along to her. And she emailed me. I remember seeing her email in my inbox and thinking maybe this is a mailing list that I forgot I signed up for. I knew who she was, of course, from all my research. And then I realized, no, this is directly to me. So we had a call with her where she sort of wanted to gauge if we were the real deal and in this for the right reasons and really passionate about telling the story and determined that we were, in fact, the real deal, and she wanted to work with us. And she's been a huge blessing to the whole production. She read early drafts of the script and made sure that we were really adhering to the story of what happened. And it is a fictional film. It's inspired by the true events, but all the characters are fictional. The conversations are fictional. But I think the biggest compliment that we've gotten from the film was that when Judith watched it early on, she said, "It's so funny, this obviously is fictionalized and this isn't exactly what happened, but it feels like what happened. This is what it was like."
You know, I've talked with a lot of female directors who lament that the fact that a lot of producers, generally male, don't want to take a chance on female-driven stories. What was your experience like in trying to pitch this and secure funding? Was it an easy process?
We had some meetings early on with male producers and studio heads, and they sort of a blanket statement said, it's interesting, but I don't really know why it's relevant. Like, is this really an important story? Who really cares about this issue? And this is also, granted, before the election. This is in 2016. And I remember one studio head said to us, "You know, if Trump gets elected, you're going to have no problem selling this." And I said, "Well, I hope it doesn't come to that, because I really never thought that it would."
And of course, now it seems even more relevant with everything that's happening in Alabama and Missouri.
Uncannily so, I would say.
The timing of the release of this film was not intentional anyway, was it? Like, in terms of, because obviously you didn't know this was going to happen.
No, and it's so bizarre because it's becoming more relevant with every passing day. We had our premiere for the movie on Tuesday. So all of us were in the theater watching this movie about what happened in the world of reproductive rights 50 years ago. We get out of the theater, everyone starts turning on their phones, and we see that suddenly we are right back to that time. It's so scary.
You know, we're talking a lot about stories about women and women-led films, and we're starting to see more of that now. Of course, there was Hidden Figures a couple years ago. Loving in a way was about an important moment in history.
Yeah.
Why is it this time that we're in now that we're finally starting to see these stories that we should have told 20, 30 years ago about important women of history?
It's a little hard to speak to with my film in particular, since, I mean, movies take a long time to get made, so I don't know that I can speak to the whole trend, but in general, I feel like artists have a responsibility to tell important stories. We're sort of the people who can teach everyone morality and how to handle conversations. And my old acting teacher, Anthony Aveson, used to say that actors have the power to remind humans of their own humanity. And so to that end, I think in times of political turmoil, which we certainly are in, it's our responsibility to tell these stories and remind everyone of revolution and change and what is possible.
And you
which
actually,
I think is what Esther Jane accomplishes.
And you actually got a great endorsement in the trailer from Gloria Steinem, who says this movie should be seen by every American. What was the conversation with her like? Did you send her a cut and she endorsed it, or did she come to you?
We did, yeah. So she and Caroline Hirsch, our other producer, who was instrumental to the making of this film, know each other from the Miz Foundation. So they've been friends for years and years. And so when we had a cut, an early cut too, at that, Caroline sent it over to Gloria, and she loved the film. The quote is actually much, much longer than the one that we have on the poster, where she just talks about the importance of the film and the relevance and how every American should see it.
You have a great female cast. Of course, you have Sarah Ramos, who is ironically on a show called Parenthood, and Sarah Steele from The Good Fight, as well as Sophie von Hasselberg, Cody Horn, yourself. How involved were you in the casting process in finding all these women?
I wasn't super involved. Eve Battaglia, our casting director, had a big hand in that and did such a beautiful job. And a lot of the actors didn't even audition necessarily. They would have meetings with Rachel, or even in one instance, a Skype interview to sort of gauge whether they were the right fit for this character that Rachel had created. But I do remember seeing the tapes from Cody Horn's agency and saying, she is so terrific. We've got to get her. So I pushed for that. And I think that she's absolutely wonderful. And it was the biggest joy working with her. Yeah, I'm just so proud of how it all came together. And, I mean, this was an independent film. All of these actors were working for much less than I'm sure they're used to, because they felt so passionately about telling the story.
Was it always a foregone conclusion that you were going to be in the film as well?
It was, yes. I'm an actor primarily,
yes.
So I put this together, and when I brought it to Rachel, I said, I'm going to play the lead, and let's put this all together and tell the story.
Is it a different experience for you as an actor being in a project that you had such a close personal relationship with?
I would actually say the biggest difficulty was in wearing so many hats, because I was a producer on this film in earnest. I remember I was shooting an intimate scene with Ben Rappaport, who plays my boyfriend and then fiance in the film. And we're in bed together and we're kissing and we're having this lovely quiet scene, and we break for a camera move, and our art department comes in and says, oh, what do we do? The credit card isn't working. Chase isn't letting us use the card. And then I had to get on the phone with Chase and say, yes, this is my art department. We have to buy a hospital bed. I know it sounds weird, but it's a really important prop piece for our movie. Please make the card work. And then go back into the scene and be in that beautiful, lovely, intimate place with him again. It was such a funny, weird experience.
You mentioned Ben, and I know there's a few, you know, substantial male supporting roles. Just curious, what was your conversation like with those actors, you know, supporting this powerful, female-driven story?
I mean, I think that it's a danger with the feminist movement to think about, like, men and women who hate men and misandry, because I don't think that's a piece of it. I think it's about equality. And so it's integral to have male allies, and that's who these were. One of our key producers was a man, Josh Bolin, and he was incredible. He's been doing this for over a decade, and I really don't see how we would have made the movie without him.
You know, given the reluctance of producers at the start to get behind a project like this, what has the reaction been since you've started showing the movie to people?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. It's funny because every single screening that we had at festivals, and there were a lot of them, every time I could go in person, I did, and people would come up to me after the screenings, and sometimes even in the talkbacks, which is a public setting, women would be sharing their own stories of abortions. And strangers would come up to me at parties afterwards and tell me these intimate stories, some of whom they said they'd never shared this with anyone else, and they'd been wanting to and wanting to tell the story and get this off their chest and share it with someone. There's so much shame surrounding this, and it's a medical procedure, and it's one that each woman makes for herself or each person makes for themselves. And I think that the more stigma surrounding that, the more dangerous it is, and the more likely that people will do it in unsafe ways. So it's important to destigmatize it, and it's important to share those stories and to talk to each other. And that's really been happening in a big way. One of my favorite stories, I think it was at a screening in Tucson, Arizona. It was the Jewish International Film Festival. And a woman came up to me afterwards and said, "This was so important. I lived through this time period, and it was especially exciting to come to this film today because I'm here with my daughter, and right now she's the age that I was when I had my abortion." And it was really special to share this together.
We're seeing artists all over the world, whether it's in Hollywood or music, speak up a lot about issues, whether it's abortion or gay rights or animal rights or whatever. Do you think that art is inherently political and inherently activist?
I do, actually. I think that the media that we consume shapes the way that we see the world. And even if you don't have an outwardly intentional political bent, people are going to see those stories and they're going to find the political bent in it. I think that artists are activists, and that's why we have that responsibility to do good with that.
I know Judith Arcana as well sort of follows a similar philosophy. In terms of the stories that you want to tell, both as an actor and as a writer as well, is there something specific that you look for in a project?
It just has to be something that I feel passionately about, usually a social justice issue that it's hard to put into words exactly. I just feel it. It's this feeling in my gut or in my solar plexus that this is the story that I have to tell. I'm in early development right now on my next feature, and this one is entirely fiction. It's not based on true events, but it still deals with similar subject matter to Ask for Jane in that it's a story of women and female friendship and people helping each other, and the crux of the action is a social justice issue, which is domestic violence against women. But that's not the focus of it. It's just sort of the catalyst for the events that unfold. But those are the things that I'm drawn to. I really needed to have a component of social justice and something that can do good.
Someone once said that the reason why so many artists get involved in activist causes is because maybe they are inherently more compassionate than other, you know, subcultures or other members of society.
Hmm.
Is that something you ascribe to?
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I do pride myself as an actor, and I think it's part of what makes a good actor is being able to look at all sides of an argument and really empathize with other people and where they're coming from. So even if you yourself don't necessarily agree with the matter at hand, you understand why someone would think that way, because if you're playing a character that thinks the opposite way of you, you can't judge them while you're playing them. Nobody thinks that they're wrong. Villains, if you're playing a villain, the villain doesn't think what they're doing is wrong. They think they're coming from a just place. And so you have to get into the mindset of what does that mean? Why do they, how do they justify that for themselves? So in terms of that, I think that theory does make sense just because we're so, we have to get around all sides of things and understand where people are coming from, which does lead to compassion, I think.
Speaking of compassion, I know we touched briefly on the horrific bills that were passed in Alabama and then today in Missouri as well. And it seems like we're moving backwards. But do you feel that there's hope in the future, maybe for 2020 or beyond?
I don't really know how to answer that because I've always considered myself sort of an aggressive optimist. I remember when I was watching the election in 2016 with a group of friends, and we're watching the map and it's turning more and more red and people are less cheerful and drinking more. And I remember saying, guys, you don't know what's going to happen. Look at all these states that are still undetermined. It could still be fine. It could be Hillary. Who knows? It's all going to be great. Just an aggressive optimist. And I was wrong then. So I don't know. But I like to think that the younger generations are increasingly more open-minded and forward-thinking. And I have a lot of faith in my generation and younger, and I hope that we can affect change. And I think a lot of people are talking about these issues and things that matter to us in a more outspoken way than ever before.
You know, it's interesting, you know, other than the states, if you look at some of the most important or relevant or powerful world leaders, at least three of them are women, May, Merkel, and Ardern. Does the world become inherently less violent when women are in positions of power?
It's hard to make a blanket statement, but I would think yes. I do. And I don't know how much is, you know, ingrained nature versus nurture. But I do feel like women are less prone to violence and are more prone to looking at different sides of things and trying to understand where people are coming from. And I don't want that to sound misandrist at all, because I love men and I love male allies and I believe in the goodness of all people.
But it is an interesting phenomenon. Like after what happened in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern within 2 days was able to pass, you know, sweeping reform, which would never happen in the States. Have you thought at all about why that is?
I think that in America, we're so divided in a weird way. Even within political factions, there's a lot of like internal policing of terms, and if you say one. To try to speak articulately and say exactly what it is that I mean, because if I say something wrong, I wouldn't want someone to jump on me and then have the whole point be ruined when it might be a really valid, important point. And I think because that's happening all over our country and we are so careful, it makes it harder to band together sometimes and to all get on the same side of an issue and to pass reforms like that. And a lot of people are not hearing each other. And that's on the opposite sides, the left and the right wings of politics. People just aren't hearing each other. If they're trying to have a debate, it's not really a debate because neither side is willing to compromise or to let themselves have their mind be changed. So maybe it's different in other countries.
You mentioned that you wish you read the story of the Jane Collective, you know, in a textbook or in history class. What do you think we need to do as a society to become aware of more stories like these and get away from sort of the very patriarchal center that runs a lot of the educational institutions?
Well, I didn't read about it in a textbook, and I think that was part of the problem, that it wasn't taught in schools. I didn't learn about it until a documentary that I saw in my late 20s. And I think a big part of that is who's telling the stories, right? Because heretofore, most of the stories have been written by men, often white men, often straight white men, which is nothing against them. You know, my partner is a straight white man, but I think that you need to have diversity in voices who are telling the stories that we're listening to. And that's both in textbooks and stories. That's also in film and TV. I think it's amazing that writers' rooms are becoming more diverse and more inclusive, because if you don't have a lived experience as a certain type of person, how can you effectively tell their story unless you talk to someone who has lived that experience, you know?
In terms of, you know, other maybe female stories that are centered in history or, you know, a specific historical figure, is there one or two stories out there or one or two people out there that you would like to see stories told about that maybe we aren't familiar with?
I was just talking with my partner last night about the Radium Girls. Have you heard about them?
No, I have not.
I don't remember what year this was. Maybe you have a concept. It was factory girls who were working with, I think it was Radium, and they would paint watch faces so that they would glow in the dark. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, okay.
Like that glow, and these chemicals were incredibly toxic, but of course there were no long-term studies. And so it would be a party trick where at bars at night, these girls, you would turn off the lights and they would literally glow in the dark. And then later you would find that they'd been hideously poisoned and there were all kinds of horrifying complications and medical problems. Just because no one had thought to do studies and these women were handling these toxins with their bare hands and sometimes with their tongues. They would lick the little paintbrushes to get them to the fine point so they could paint the watch faces. Their tongues would be covered in radium. So I was just thinking about that story last night, and my partner said, "Oh, you should make a movie about that." I don't know if something already has been, but that's an interesting story.
Yeah, no, I think there's been like a couple of plays about them. There was an interesting series here in Canada a couple years ago called Bomb Girls, which was fictional.
I heard about that. I haven't seen it.
But it's about four women who were working in a munitions factory during World War II. Again, a fictional story, but kind of along the same lines. So there was that, and but now that you mentioned the Radium Girls, it definitely does
rings a bell.
Does sound familiar for sure.
Yeah.
In terms of women out there who are doing great and powerful things, whether it's in, you know, as an artist in the entertainment world, or as a politician, or as a business person, is there anybody out there that really sticks out to you?
I'm actually really inspired by some of the people who have been helping us with the film. Andrea Miller, she's the president of the National Institute for Reproductive Health, and I think she's just a genius. She is so smart and empathetic and hardworking, and the whole purpose of the NIRH is to affect politics at a state and local level, which is kind of the biggest way for us to affect change in America right now. So I think the work that she and the NIRH are doing are possibly world-changing.
What do you want audiences to take away from this film when they see it?
I would like them to really get a sense of what it's like for individual women. I feel like the opponents of abortion talk around these sort of high-concept ideas without thinking about individuals who are impacted by policy. And I think it's important, and that's why I wanted to make a narrative. That's why this isn't a documentary, because I want you to be able to empathize with the women and where they're coming from and their stories, their, you know, and how different they are. You know, there's a woman who's already a mother of four and can't afford another child. And, you know, there's a teenager in high school who doesn't know anything about contraception because this is the 1960s. And there's just so many different stories. So I would love for people to go in and hear those stories and maybe change their minds about things and open their hearts more.
Well,
that's what I would hope.
The film is Ask for Jane, and I believe it actually opens in theaters today, if I'm correct.
Today, yeah. We have a screening this evening at 7 o'clock at the Village East in New York. That's going to be followed by a talk back with Heather Booth, who was the original Jane.
Yes.
Which is very exciting.
And I'm hoping it'll come to Canada. I think I read maybe next month. I'm not entirely sure, but I do think it will be coming at least to Toronto and Vancouver relatively soon. I don't know. Anyway.
I hope so, too. Our distributors and our PR folks are out in Toronto.
Oh, well, there you go. So, there's a couple of really good theaters here that would love to air it. But the film is Ask for Jane, opens today. Kate Courtleo, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Dan, thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
No worries. Have a good day, and best of luck at the screening tonight.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Have a great day, too.
Cheers.
That was my conversation with Kate Courtleo. Her new film, Ask for Jane, is out now. Well, my next guest is a Singaporean born and raised choreographer, presenter, arts educator, and artistic director. Her company is Princess Productions, which houses Tiger Princess dance projects, and she's also the founder of the biennial dance festival Made in Canada. She has been the recipient of the 2017 Muriel Sharon Award, the 2016 Jacqueline Lemieux Award, the K.M. Hunter Artist Award, the New Pioneers Arts Award, the Chalmers Arts Fellowship, Soul Peppers Community Artist Award, and the Ontario Premier's Award for Excellence in the Art New Talent. In 2000, she received a Dora Maybar Moore Award for Best Performance and has received multiple nominations. As I mentioned, she's also the founder of the Dance Made in Canada, which this year goes from August 14th to 18th at the Betty Oliphant Theatre. 2019 Dance Hall of Fame inductee Louise Lecavalier will open this year's festival with a special talk and screening of the recent documentary about her, Louise Lecavalier in Motion. In addition, there is a creative collaboration with multiple Dora Maybar Award winner Molly Johnson. She is Yvonne Ng, and I spoke with her last week about her work and the festival. Here is our conversation.
I'm here with Yvonne Ng. Yvonne, hello, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
So you are the artistic director, the curator of Dances Made in Canada.
Yeah, Dance Made in Canada.
Dance Made in Canada, and I know it's a biennial festival. And this year I read that it's quite ambitious. So you guys are actually doing 5 world premieres.
Yes.
By my account. As well as 3 Toronto premieres, I think. What's it like to premiere that many works simultaneously?
Oh, I've never really thought of it. Now I'm scared. Now I'm a little terrified. I wasn't terrified up to this point. I don't know. We do it. I don't think about it. How's that? I try not to think about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I know you personally are responsible for the Morrison series.
Yes.
Which is 3 different pieces.
Yes.
And named after the late lighting designer, I believe.
Yes, David Morrison. Yes.
What can you tell us about the pieces that are part of that specific series?
Oh. I was going to keep it as a surprise. What can I tell you? The similarities, obviously. Oh, can I beat around the bush?
Yeah, a little bit. Sure.
Okay. The similarities, and of course, a very different take on. Well, all the pieces are very different from each other. They all are, but at the same time, I think they all have a quest and a theme and a focus on life, what it means to live. Yeah.
And I know that overall, I guess, the theme for this year's festival is impact, mm-hmm. Whether it's between two humans or a collision of two objects.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go portraying that on stage in the medium of dance?
I'm going to describe my eyes. My eyes just went wider. and I'm like, okay, good question, hard question. How do I myself as a dance artist, if
yes.
I was on stage? Oh, that sounds like a making of a new piece. oh God, there's many various ways, right? There are many various ways in each. I think that's what you'll find. I'm going to turn it back to the festival. There are many ways that people have approached this, and that's why I encourage people to come to the festival, because everybody has their own approach to making art and their approach to life, how life affects and influences them and the statements that they want to make and the changes that they'd like to make. And that's kind of what you would see on stage. How I would do it as a choreographer? Oh, goodness. I think I would probably... it's a good question. Now I have to make a new piece. I think I would probably turn to probably what I said in my forward. It's looking at limitations. I think that's what life presents us with, a lot of limitations, you know, and it's just part of life. And either we embrace it, or we fight against it. And what would that look like? And I think in taking that approach, would probably manifest itself in a could manifest itself in a dance work. I'm not sure if I'd answered that very well. Okay.
On the note of limitations, you know, I always talk to artists, and we talk about, you know, shooting an independent film, for example, there's less budget, so there's more limitations on that, but yet the piece tends to be a lot better, a lot tighter than maybe something like you'll see in a big budget film, and I feel like dance can be the same way. As an artist, as a choreographer, as a performer, what does having certain limitations do for the creative process?
It's a very personal question, too, because I think everybody would take that, would absorb that and use that in different ways. I often see it as a good challenge. I see it as a different way of flourishing. I'm always intrigued and curious by that in humans and in myself, what I would do. Yeah, I think I get kind of, well, who loves to be that restricted? But at the same time, I kind of see it as exciting and fun in kind of a dark way. You know? So, yeah. Yeah. Full stop. That's it.
One of the artists that you have contributing this year is the fabulous Molly Johnson.
Yes.
I believe is a 14-time Maeve and Moore Award winner, if I'm correct.
Winner?
Or nominee.
Nominee? Oh.
Maybe.
Wow, you know the facts more than I do.
But how did you get her? How did she come aboard this festival?
She is part of the WYSIWYG, which stands for What You See is What You Get. And essentially that's a lottery-based platform, or what ends up happening is dance artists send in their proposals and then we blindly select, and she was selected. That's how she got to be a part of that. Yeah, so we're really thrilled to have her too. And I think she should have more platforms in the city.
You know, whenever you're putting something together, what does it do just for the festival, for the prestige of the festival, to have somebody who has a bit of a name, a bit of a reputation, not only in the arts community in the city, but in the country as well?
What do I do?
What does having somebody like Molly, who is a bit known, say, do for a festival like this?
Oh, well, okay, the most obvious is that it'll draw more people to us. The way the programs are formed, it's all shared programming, so there's a lot of cross-pollination. So somebody who may come to see, so for example, in her program, somebody who may come to see Seeking Bridge, which is a new collective, but may come to see Naishi, for example, may not have known about Molly, even though she's well-known in the city. So that really expands her audience base, but it also expands somebody else's. What else does it do? It gives... goodness. I think the cross-pollinization of putting different artists on shared programming allows for audiences to be experiencing artists that they may not have anticipated or expected to see, and I think that's the important thing. So I think that's what we really are proud of within the festival, that we can bring artists from across the nation to, you know, within 5 days and onto sort of one platform to express and present their statements.
I know somebody else who is involved with the festival this year. She's actually opening it. Is Louise Le Cavalier?
Yes,
who's
she
being
is.
Inducted into the
she was
Dance Hall of Fame. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're also presenting a film screening, I think.
Yeah, well, it's her film screening.
In motion. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not actually. Sorry, I always missay that. So I misspeak. So a documentary was made on her. So it's really of her work, her process. And it follows her a little bit on her tour as well. It's quite fascinating, and she's always been a fascinating performer, creator, dance artist in the country, really. Yeah, and a role model for a lot of people.
And so, how did you get her to open the festival? What went into that process? Was it just, hey, do you want to open to say some remarks, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, pretty much. We said that, you know, we wanted to show her, we approached her filmmaker, and we asked if we could, screen it. And this was the date. Would they be okay? And pretty much it was pretty simple, straight ahead. I didn't have to curtsy or bow or spin or anything. And she does, I mean, we do know each other. We're not like pals, but we know each other. And then, of course, I approached her after that so that she was aware of it. And she has been in the city. I have produced her teaching. Like, she's taught in the city for us, for another organization that I ran years ago. So there's familiarity. Plus, she has lots of friends in the city. And it's Canada. Why would she not want to show it to the rest of her Canadians, right?
I know this is a documentary, but we are seeing elements of dance, whether it's a story about dancers or just, elements of dance, a lot more in film these days. Misty Copeland was in The Nutcracker,
yes.
Then there's Natalie Portman who won the Oscar for Black Swan, there's a few others. What kind of relationship do you see between dance, contemporary dance, and film?
Oh, lots of what kind of relationship? Ha! A really fruitful one. There's lots of possibilities. And it also, in some ways, makes our dance less ephemeral. You know, it really allows us to build legacy and to have that be a record in history. It allows our dance to also go beyond just Canada. It's more portable. And in terms of creating dance for film, there's so much more possibilities, right? I mean, because editing becomes a form of choreography. The director becomes the choreographer too. And often the choreographer becomes that director. So it's another tool, so to speak. Depending on what the work is all about, not all choreographers and not all pieces want to be a film or can be,
Given that dance is a largely wordless medium compared to other forms of art storytelling, two parts. How do you go about telling a story without words? And what can you portray in a dance piece that maybe you can't in other mediums like film or radio or even writing?
What can we portray? I think we can portray quite a... In film, it depends on the angle and the cuts and the editing and all that and sort of the effects that you can put and you can layer on it. God, what was your question again?
How dance can portray a story or certain elements that other mediums can't?
I think the story that... Okay. Dance can portray a linear story. It often portrays a non-linear narrative. But it can portray the inner expression or inner... God, this requires a very smart answer. I need time. He's looking at me and smiling now. He's like, I got her. Obviously, I think it can portray a lot. If not, I wouldn't be spending a lot of my time invested in it. I think it's because we live in our bodies so much. I think we all have stories. I think the story that, perhaps it's just the word, we're kind of confined by what the definition of a story means. You know, what we expect a story to be, that it has to be read in a certain way, and we often liken it to sort of literary arts, that it has to kind of flow in a linear sort of way. And I think, I suppose, in a way, our lives kind of do. There's always a beginning, middle, and an end to any aspect of our lives, but also to art making. But that said, I think dance can really touch one's another, sorry, the receiver's soul, and the unconscious state. It can have a deeper imprint. It can have also a reoccurring sort of sensation. Often when I walk away from exquisite art, dance works, I have these lingering sensations or lingering images that are thought-provoking, and it kind of is sometimes a portal into other, into my other ways of thinking, and it challenges my own philosophy and my approach to living and my also approach to what I feel life is about, can be about.
You've toured all around the world with Tiger Princess. What do you like about creating work in Canada, and what do you make of the dance community within this country?
Oh, it's so rich. What do I like about it? Well, that I have freedom of speech. I'm from Singapore, so freedom of speech, access to a lot of, not a lot, but access to resources. It's not just about financial resources, but to other collaborating artists and space like this. We happen to be sitting in a studio right now. The possibilities and probabilities are all there, and it's just what we make of it and what we want to make of it. The support that I feel that we get from the local community and national, provincial and national community. But I think knowing that I can make what I want to make is a big thing. You know, not having to worry about looking over my shoulder. But within where I live, the honesty that I can bring to it, hopefully. The second part question was, what was the second part question?
Basically what do you think of the dance community, both in this city and in the country?
What I find so delicious and so amazing and exquisite and so rewarding is that artists from different parts of Canada, you know, whether it's east to west, north to south, are making. So, for example, if you as you said earlier, like, you know, there's this sort of reoccurring theme on sort of impact of within all the different art pieces that are being presented, none of these pieces look alike, you know, and it's quite reflective of the space, the land, the nature that we all live in, and it kind of is somewhat reflective of that. And that's what I find so wonderful and wondrous and inspiring. Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, art, I mean, if you go to see work in Montreal, it's so different than seeing work in Vancouver, it's so different than seeing work out in Halifax, and, you know, even up in, you know, people making work up in Sudbury. And so, and it doesn't even have to go that far. You could go out to, like, Guelph and they're making work, it's different.
Well, the work is Dance Made in Canada, and
it sure is.
August 14th to 18th at Betty Oliphant Theatre.
Yes, it is.
Yvonne Ng, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
That was my guest, Yvonne Ng. The Dance Made in Canada Festival, or Fehu Canada Festival, goes on stage August 14th to 18th in 2019 at the Betty Oliphant Theatre. That does it for me today. My thanks to Yvonne Ng and my thanks to Kate Corteliu. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.